got to say little this just long as I can be. Now my God got a heart like rock in the sea. And beat my soul, my baby's trying to beat me. Got to say this just long as I can get me.
Welcome to the Jazz Treasury. I'm Rich Sylvester. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode again, where we look at Jazz City, Paris. And that first track you heard was Louis Armstrong. Long time ago, Louis Armstrong. That was from 1934, recorded in Paris. Louis Armstrong and his orchestra doing St. Louis Blues. So today you'll be hearing some music that gathers together some of the best sides cut in Paris, by visiting musicians with examples of the recorded work of the finest soloists and bands from the first generation of French jazz. So, Jazz City Paris, the City of Light, as Parisians like to call their home, provided fertile soil for jazz to take root and grow during the 1920s and 1930s. More liberal at that period than the British in their attitude to foreign visitors, the French welcomed large numbers of black American musicians, such as Dickie Wells, whose work stimulated many local players. Although native jazzmen usually went without honor in their own country, the quintet of the Hot Club de France, and especially Django Reinhardt, were popular stars even during the German occupation. The story of jazz in Paris is largely a story of French musicians learning to play in a new musical language. To some extent, it has much in common with the history of jazz in London. An important difference, however, is that a far greater number of American players settled in Paris for longer or shorter periods. Their presence helped the development of local musicians, but at the same time frequently stole their thunder. The trend was set early on by the arrival, in the last year of World War I, of the U.S. Army's 369th Infantry Regiment Band, nicknamed the Hellfighters. This large black outfit directed by Lieutenant James Reese Europe had Bill Bojangles Robinson as its drum major. He was later succeeded by Noble Sissy. Although ostensibly charged with morale raising among American troops over there, they had an even greater impact on the locals. In the words of the band's executive officer, the crowd cheered without ceasing. Women and children wept. And so we move on. Here, another tune, another track here. This one from the one and only Django Reinhardt, who continues to influence guitarists to this day. And we're going to listen to a track, Blues d'Autrefois, by Django Reinhardt, and it's recorded in Paris, 1943. Let's listen to Django Reinhardt Et son orchestra, Blues d'autrefois, on the Jazz Treasury. There you go, that's Django. Et son orchestra, Blues d'autrefois. Recorded in Paris in 1943. Hot Club Quintet bassist Louis Vola said Django didn't read music, but he had ears like an elephant. You understand? This explains how his several wartime big band record sessions contained so many of his own compositions. He used to dictate his arranging. Well, the Americans played in a style streets ahead of ragtime. The foxtrot bands, or what was heard of the intellectuals' nightclub, La Boite sur le Toit, which opened at the end of 1921, taking its name from a Brazilian song, this club was where classical composers such as Ravel first heard something like jazz. Although according to trombonist Leo Vachon, the music was dominated by rikki-tikki piano. Despite that, a boite became the standard French expression for a jam session. A generation of young French musicians, including Stefan Gappelli, heard Mitchell's records or saw the groups that capitalized on Mitchell's success. Django Reinhardt, for example, who was reportedly intrigued by his first sighting of Billy Arnold's band, a white American group working in the Piglia district. In contrast, the general public resisted the intrusion of jazz through most of the 1920s and in most venues. They tended to prefer native French popular music or a watered-down version of American dance music. So the few French-born pioneers, such as Stefan Gappelli and trumpeter Philippe Brun, found little opportunity to play jazz together outside the occasional student function, but many were in the right place at the right time when in 1928, a Turkish dancer and band manager called Gregor, having talked himself into a sudden debut as band leader, hastily assembled a group from the denizens of the favorite musician's bar, the Tabac Piguel. By 1928, the jazz provided by the visiting Americans had improved by several notches. Sidney Bechet, who had spent several weeks in 1925 playing with Claude Hopkins's band in La Revue Negra, returned to Paris to join the band at the new late-night club Bricktops, named for its owner, the singer Ada Smith. Let's do another track here. Let's move on. Someone you may have heard of, Coleman Hawkins. Coleman Hawkins spent a good deal of time in France, and this is a track called Stardust, classic standard called Stardust, and it features Coleman Hawkins on tenor sax, Stefan Grappelli on piano. Yeah, Stefan first started his musical career playing piano, and later went on, of course, to play a great violin. And so Stefan Grappelli's playing piano, Django Reinhardt on guitar, Eugene Del Hermes on bass, and Maurice Chalot on drums. Recorded in Paris in 1935, let's listen to Coleman Hawkins with Stefan Grappelli and Django Reinhardt doing Stardust on the Jazz Treasury.
Listening to the Jazz Treasury Podcast with Rich Sylvester.
Well, after an early diet of record recitals, the Hot Club's first concert early in 1934 featured Django Reinhardt, who astounded everyone present. A stream of American jazz figures, including Armstrong and later Duke Ellington, expressed their surprise at and enthusiasm for the French guitarist. Almost without realizing it, Reinhardt effortlessly combined the improvisation of gypsy music, which he had played obsessively since the age of 12, with the popular songs that formed the infrastructure of jazz. In the process, he created a new dialect within jazz, a fact that eventually inspired generations of European musicians to believe they could do more than just imitate the Americans. He seemed to arrive at his own style in one bound, while most other budding French jazzers were still groping towards the light. He quickly became the leading figure in the first all-French, all-jazz group, the official quintet of the Hot Club. They went on to work at chic clubs and at high society parties with bookings frequently arranged through Bricktops, where the group often played. Their bassist, Louis Vola, noted, "We didn't need a piano or drums. It was what the rich people wanted, not too much noise. And people used to say, it's funny, with this band, I find they can dance." Those qualities led to some early misgivings about the group's authenticity as jazz, especially on the part of critics, such as Passé and England's Max Jones, but its popularity was not in doubt. They broadcast live to the UK and the USA and undertook lengthy English tours in 1938 and 1939. All right, let's spin another track. How about we go to Stefan Grappelli here? And this is Stefan Grappelli playing piano. And it's a solo piano piece called T for Two, another classic standard T for Two. And this is recorded in Paris in 1947. Let's listen to Stefan Grappelli playing T for Two. Stefan Grappelli, T for Two, Stefan playing the piano there. So there was a strong impression in the 1930s that Paris was where the scene was at its most swinging. Sadly, things were about to change in a major way, with the threatening noises coming out of Nazi Germany and the knock-on effects of French rearmament on the economy Doc Cheatham had spent time in Paris with Sam Wooding years earlier, but returning to Paris on vacation in summer 1939 commented that everything seemed to have closed down and people seemed to be having a hard time. I could tell that. Most musicians, not being political animals, tried their best to ignore the situation, but were often brought face to face with reality. The Hot Club Quintet had visa trouble in 1939 when traveling to Sweden via Germany, which had already refused Coleman Hawkins' permission to tour. Nearly all the black musicians left Europe by the autumn of 1939, although Willie Lewis's band took work in Belgium and Holland, moving to neutral Switzerland when those countries were invaded, then returning to the USA via Portugal. Official Nazi policy was that blacks, gypsies, and homosexuals were as inferior, quote-unquote, as Jews, and that jazz music, whose performers contained such a high proportion of both blacks and Jews, was automatically decadent. How about one final, a name you probably don't hear very much, a gentleman named Bill Coleman, but this guy can swing. I've heard him for the first time here on this recording, and I've been listening to jazz for 40-some-odd years, but this is a track featuring Bill Coleman and Et Son Orchestra, the same one that Django played with earlier. This is called Bill Street Blues. Features Bill Coleman playing the trumpet, Stefan Capelli on violin, Joseph Reinhardt on guitar, Wilson Myers on bass, and Ted Fields on drums, 1937 in Paris. Let's listen to Bill Coleman and the Et Son Orchestra doing Bill Street Blues on the Jazz Treasury. That's Bill Coleman, Bill Street Blues, 1937, Stefan Capelli on violin. One of the chief factors in the history of jazz in France was the acceptance of black performers. By 1920, thanks to Lieutenant James Europe, it was widely believed that blacks were better at making this new music than even the American white bands, let alone the locals. African contributions to the arts were being highly regarded by Europeans for the first time ever, while influential Paris-based painters such as Picasso appreciated the primitive beauty of African sculptures, there was also an openness among French high society to African-born but European-trained writers. Authors from France's colonies were praised for literature which was written in French but supposedly flavored with negritude. As a result, African-American jazzmen, such as Coleman Hawkins, suffered only positive discrimination. They were treated not only as serious musicians, but also as equal citizens, especially when consorting with French women. The downside, for jazz appreciation at least, is that there was a form of reverse racism operating. The white New York bands of the later 1920s, so admired in the UK as well as the West Coast school of the 1950s, are only now receiving some attention in France after decades of neglect. And speaking of blacks, the Nazis were equally inconsistent towards blacks, imprisoning, among others, Arthur Briggs, Freddie Johnson, and guitarist Maceo Jefferson, and John Mitchell, who had left the Willie Lewis's band while in Holland, who were repatriated to the USA only in 1944. Django was in a particularly ambiguous category all of his own. While Grappelli stayed in England, Reinhardt was the most popular figure in French jazz, as well as the Hot Club Quintet. He was able to front his own big band. As a nonconformist gypsy, he was a symbol of resistance, and there was even a youth fashion for dressing in imitation English-American clothes, plus Django-style mustaches. Django also became a mainstream idol. When he came to a town for a concert, people knew that something happy was going to happen for a change. He was obliged, though, to appear compliant with the authorities, and a game of cat and mouse ensued as to whether he would play in Germany. In his efforts to avoid an agreement being reached, he asked for 120,000 francs per concert. After the liberation of Paris in 1944, it was widely accepted that Reinhardt was beyond accusations of collaboration. Indeed, comparatively few French jazzmen suffered from this backlash. In the aftermath of war, Grappelli returned home, and a generation of players grew up who were influenced by bebop, including pianist Marcel Solal, bassist Pierre Michelot, and saxophonist Barney Willen, with further down the line violinist Jean-Luc Ponty, who inherited the instrument given by Michel Warlop to Grappelli. Another name to look for if you're new to jazz, and especially in some of the recordings of the 1970s and 1980s, Jean-Luc Ponty. Check it out. All right, let's listen to our final recording here on this edition of the Jazz Treasury, featuring Jazz City, Paris. Let's listen to Willie Lewis and his entertainers doing another standard, All of Me. Great band here, by the way, featuring Bobby Martin, and Alex Renard on trumpet, Benny Carter on tenor, alto, and the arranger, Willie Lewis, George Johnson on alto saxes, Joe Heyman and Charles Coco Keon on tenor sax, Herman Chittison on piano, John Mitchell on guitar, and June Cole on bass. Oh, and Ted Fields on drums. Let's listen to Willie Lewis and his entertainers doing All of Me, Paris, 1936. Thank you. Okay, that was Willie Lewis and his entertainers. In the 1950s, Paris was also a magnet for players from other French-speaking countries. These included saxophonist Bobby Jasper from Belgium, drummer Daniel Humer from Switzerland, and bassist Jackie Sampson from Martinique. The racial tension in 1960s America led to further transatlantic traffic involving Bud Powell, Kenny Drew, Dexter Gordon, Johnny Griffin, and Phil Woods. If you're new to jazz, please note those names, and I think they deserve to be repeated. Bud Powell, Kenny Drew, Dexter Gordon, Johnny Griffin, Phil Woods, and many others. Indeed, Griffin is still based in the French provinces. As in other countries, there was a lull in jazz's popularity during the 1970s, but when the dust cleared, it became evident that many local musicians were on the same level as many Americans. The Paris jazz scene continues to flourish and maintains a reputation for musical activity commensurate with the city's history. I want to tell you about some future listening. You might be able to do some recommended listening. The post-war jazz scene in Paris not only produced many fine recordings by ex-patriot artists, but also saw the flowering of local talent. For example, listen to Sidney Bechet's album or song Spirits of New Orleans in 1949. Dexter Gordon spent a lot of time in France. Our Man in Paris, great recording, 1963. Jean-Luc Ponty. And finally, Martial Solal, Vogue Recordings, Volume 2, 1954 to 1956. Well, all right, that's it for this edition, this episode of the Jazz Treasury Podcast. My name is Rich Sylvester. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for spreading the word of jazz, keeping the flame of jazz alive, talking to your friends, talk to your family. I should let you know that most of the information I get for the Jazz Treasury Podcast is from a great publication that was put out back in the 90s called Jazz Greats, and put out by the Marshall Cavendish Foundation. And they had a CD come out every 2 weeks, and they had a CD with a magazine attached to it with different topics, different musicians, different features. And a lot of the information I get is from that. So hats off to Jazz Greats Magazine. Feel free to go to our Facebook page, give us a like, post something if you wish, give us a review, and also on iTunes, please review, rate. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Next time on the Jazz Treasury, we're listening to Jump Jazz. As the big swing bands faded from the scene in the 1940s, a new kind of jazz arrived that created a big sound out of small resources. All over the USA, but especially on the West Coast, Jump Jazz combos played peppy dance tunes and smoochy blues. People like Lucky Thompson, Illinois Jacquette, Roy Milton, and Jack McVie, with singers like Dana Washington and Jimmy Witherspoon. That's what's up next time. Thanks for listening. Until next time, enjoy the jazz.